Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader back here once again with one of these remote Truth and Movies specials. This episode, we're going transatlantic. I'm very thrilled to welcome to the show Little White Lies stalwart Charles Bromesco.
Hello
Charles,
there.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's good to be on. It's good to be back.
So, Charles, yes, last time we spoke, you were in London. Where are you now?
I'm at home. I am quarantining at my apartment in Brooklyn, New York. I've been here for the past few months now. It's been 3 months to the day, because I began on March 10th. Here with my girlfriend and my roommate, everyone keeping each other sane. Lots of movies to watch, lots of food to be cooked. So, you know, keeping ourselves busy.
And are you safe and well? Is everybody okay?
Yeah, definitely. There's been a lot of police violence in America recently, as I'm sure mm-hmm. you've been reading about, and a lot of that has been centralized in my neighborhood of Crown Heights. But fortunately for me, that has been located at the other end of the neighborhood, and that all of my loved ones have stayed out of the way of harm. But I'm hoping that positive change can be affected soon, as is everyone in New York.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. As we are internationally as well, I'm glad to hear that you're safe.
Yeah.
So this week, the topic of the show is, I guess, the rise of the Netflix. And this is off the back of a new release coming to Netflix this Friday, which is Spike Lee's Da 5 Bloods, which I haven't seen yet. You've seen, right?
Yes, I got the screener just yesterday. I watched it, right after getting it. I couldn't wait. Really hugely impressive movie. I think that Spike has entered this sort of a really exciting late phase of his career where it's just these grand visions that are toying with genre, that are toying with huge ideas that go crashing into each other with thrilling results. So this is about a crew of Vietnam veterans who return to Saigon in the present day to retrieve a cache of gold and the remains of their fallen leader out in the jungle, along with one of the soldiers' son. And the things that befall them once they're actually in the jungle, I don't want to say too much, both because I don't want to spoil anything and because there will be people, critics more well-equipped to comment on the genius of this movie than I am, but just in terms of artistry form, it's a really staggering achievement, I would say. It's toying with the tropes of the Vietnam movie as we know them, but then also building onto them, spikifying them. He definitely has a singular style that he imbues this movie with that, it's thrilling stuff to watch.
I really can't wait to watch it this weekend. I know there's a review going up on lwlies.com by previous guest Layla Latif, and I can't wait to read that as well.
Sure.
And I can't wait to dive into this movie. I hear that Delroy Lindo, South London's finest, is particularly good.
I didn't even know he's British. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. He is, yeah, he and Clark Peters, I think, definitely get the most meat to chew on, and they're incredible. Delroy Lindo, one of the soldiers, he has become a Trump voter. He's sort of a far right type in America, and one of the big questions this movie kind of tries to tangle with is the sort of oxymoronic question of the black Trump voter. Like, how does this work? Someone whose political philosophy is so rooted in racism, how can a person be black and support him? And the film, really painstakingly, it's 2.5 hours long, lays out a psychological rationale for how someone could get to that political stance. It's brilliant stuff.
Terrific. And let's go from perhaps the sublime of Spike Lee to potentially the ridiculous. of the body of work that Netflix has put out on their system over the last, what, 5 years since they started putting out original films?
One of the first films that they released in 2015, their first major prestige release was Beasts of No Nation, the Idris Elba picture where he plays an African warlord who is sort of exerting his sway over a child soldier played by Abraham Atta. And ever since then, they've released, not including documentaries, just narrative films alone, over 350 movies. And then once you're adding in documentaries, that's, hundreds more, stand-up specials, TV series. It's a truly, truly towering amount of content to have been released in such a short span of time.
So we've asked you on for this episode, Charles, because you are something of an expert of the Netflix. There's the fantastic ongoing project you have over on the Vulture website of ranking every single Netflix original. So in some ways, you're the best person for this topic and the best person to answer what is a Netflix. You already teased you're not including stand-up specials, you're not including documentaries. That might be a bit controversial, maybe.
I'm a human man, only so many hours in a day. I had to give myself some parameters just to make this work doable in the first place. I started this assignment in 2016, I believe, when the grand number was much more manageable. I believe it was about 60-ish movies back then. And then a year later, I did another update of everything that had been released in the past year, which was at that point also, I think, about 60 more. And then from there, I've been doing monthly updates. And I really had no idea how much of my life this would come to occupy. It's been edifying, definitely, but they've released a lot of clunkers.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
We should ask the question up front. You say there are a lot of clunkers. What's their batting average overall?
So I was looking back at it, and I would say it's something about, one in every five movies is solidly watchable to good. Which, I don't know, you think about it, if you look at the average of something like Universal, it's closer to one in four, or maybe one in three, which is not all that more impressive. But when you think about it in terms of producing a slate of 10, 15 movies in a year versus producing, 110 movies in a year, it's kind of amazing that one studio can afford to make so many bad movies.
Yeah. And do you see any broad trends here? Are there certain genres or type of film that they seem to be better at or better suited at doing?
I'm glad you asked. Yes, definitely. There are, if you watch all of these movies month in and month out, really discernible patterns start to emerge of, a lot of these movies are greenlit by algorithmic favor. So what you can see is that if there is one movie that works, they will then commission four more movies that are very similar inflections of that just because, then they'll have something to recommend to people after they've watched To All the Boys I've Loved Before. And so, yeah, the YA teen romance has been a huge staple, major staple, really reliably successful. The most recent one being called The Half of It, which is a sort of Cyrano de Bergerac remix, except the girl who helps the guy write letters to his amour. It's not that the two of them end up together, it's that the girl is a lesbian and has a crush on the girl who she is helping this fellow court. Bit convoluted, not super funny. That's a recurring theme in a lot of these teen-geared comedies. Not super funny. That's a lot of it. There are a lot of... So I watch all the foreign films a lot, and that is illuminating in its own way. You see a lot of sort of street-level crime pictures out of France and Spain, a lot of Indian social dramas. I don't know the way they arrive at these decisions, but I would love to talk to someone at Netflix and be like, why is this the thing you're doing? They do not so many films from Japan, but quite a few from China. A lot of neorealist dramas about like youth and revolts, unrest, that kind of thing. There's a good movie called River's Edge, which I actually liked quite a bit. And then apart from that, in the U.S., they have a lot of dramas about achieving your dreams, about, you know, people who are trying to get out of their small town or their provincial part of a large city and you know, attain stardom in some respect. But their family doesn't want them to. It's boilerplate shit like that.
I like what you say about if they have one success, they'll commission three more like it. I wonder if after The Irishman, we'll get The Englishman, Scotsman, and Welshman.
The Welshman, that would be good. And then The Northern Irishman would be a decidedly different film from The Irishman.
Exactly.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose the thing that's interesting about Netflix is that we view them in some ways, you're looking at the landscape of film production companies and brands, we look at an Annapurna or an A24 who have a slate of... you know, a handful of films, maybe 10 at most a year, which or you know, where you can get your head around it, you can see every single one, you are a fan of their output and you know what you're getting, whereas Netflix seems to want to be this smorgasbord that tries to please almost everyone.
Well, it's odd because you're right in that they do release just sort of everything, just sort of aiming the fire hose at the wall and whatever sticks. But that is sort of how it works in that someone who enjoys one sort of movie from Netflix has a very easy time ignoring everything else. It's not as if they'll be led astray. And, you know, someone who enjoys the teen comedy Let It Snow, starring Kiernan Shipka of The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, someone who enjoys that isn't just going to watch The Irishman just because it's on Netflix. It's understood more as something like YouTube, which is a platform rather than a curator of content. Netflix just kind of has things. And so that's why... it is kind of strange, though, because younger people, and this chills me to the bone, but they will refer to as watching Netflix much in the same way one would say watching TV.
It's his own platform.
Yeah, very creepy.
You find that creepy?
In the way that they've permeated the market to that extent, like in the way that someone says, you know, grab me a Kleenex when they mean a tissue, if someone's just watching Netflix to refer to watching, you know, entertainment, moving picture entertainment on their computer, that is a frightening totality of influence there. That's, I don't know, I'm very paranoid about these things because I've seen too many of their movies.
Well, of course, and then I suppose in the past, the medium was always served by many distributors of
exactly,
content,
yeah.
Exhibitors and so on, whereas now if the medium is all the platform and the medium is also the creator.
I also say that part of the issue is that Netflix so dominates this market that you know, the main competitors, which are at this point Amazon Prime and Hulu, they don't release anywhere close to the number of movies that Netflix releases. They're operating a little bit more like traditional studios in that they're judicious about what they choose and when they release it, but Netflix is just kind of trying to drown them in an avalanche of content.
I think we should dig into some films in a second, but do you think this bubble will burst?
Eventually it has to, yes. So, you know, the big thing is that they pride themselves on not being an original studio. We're disruptors. They run themselves not like a studio, but like a tech company, like a tech startup, which means that unlike movie studios where money is everything, that you're sunk if you cannot produce a return on investment by the time that the movie is released, Netflix can just keep rolling its debt into itself because it doesn't have flops. They don't tell people how many clicks each title gets, because I guess that would expose how many of these things aren't watched by anybody, I assume. I would love to see those numbers as well. Should call for some more transparency there. My point being that they have so much debt that eventually this, I would refer to it as a house of cards, rather ironic metaphor, but it has to fall down. There's no there. There's no foundation. It's just, they can't keep accruing debt forever.
Well, let's look at through some of their biggest hits and biggest misses then. And since you're the guy that's seen pretty much all of them, which would you want to go to first?
I should have got this article up here too. I'll take a look at that as well. I will say that I was kind of just mentally running through to what extent Netflix has earned this legitimacy as a movie studio. And to their credit, they have brought us a Spike Lee movie, a Coen Brothers movie, and a Martin Scorsese movie. I really, not a lot to be said about that. They got me there.
Exactly, yeah. And I think there are certain filmmakers that really owe Netflix with their careers, Mike Flanagan being one of them. He speaks about how even in his... You know, before he'd made actual branded Netflix content, he had some of his early independent films were bought by Netflix, acquired for their platform. So he's very pro Netflix in terms of what he does.
Yeah. So going through the top of the list now, I mean, I'd say probably the greatest service to society ever performed by Netflix was that they brought us The Other Side of the Wind, the finished cobbled together edit. They got that to the public, which is quite an achievement. I really thought I would never see it. Ever. That's major. Just last year, I was a huge fan of Marriage Story. I think that's one of the best movies they've ever released. I put that at number 3 on my list. I was really, really impressed by a new sensitivity from Noah Baumbach, who I've felt is sort of aloof at times. Just the acting from Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, on all counts. I love Roma, Alfonso Cuarón, Okja, which was Bong Joon-ho's prior film to the big break Parasite. Buster Scruggs, to Private Life, which is a lovely drama by Tamara Jenkins about a couple working to conceive a child. A very sensitively drawn movie, very well written, well acted by Paul Giamatti and Catherine Hahn. And so they, I mean, even just going through the top 10, that's a very respectable slate. To have released those really over the course of a few years is a lot to be proud of. If it was not so, you know, deeply embedded within a bigger cache of crap.
Do you buy the party line that they have these deep pockets that can fund films that could never be made elsewhere? So The Irishman and the huge budget behind it, or
yeah, well, I mean, I do to an extent feel like I like Netflix insofar as it's the place that aging auteurs go to make their longest, most expensive movies. Defy Bloods is 2 hours, 35 minutes. It definitely feels like it has not been mediated by the influence of the studio in any way. Irishman is 3 hours. Buster Scruggs, very long. And so I think it's strange. If you are a name auteur and I think you go to Netflix, they will give you a lot of creative latitude. They'll leave you alone. They won't note you to death. But if you are someone who is hired for one of their jobs, not necessarily a filmmaker that they're trying to collaborate with, but someone who they've brought in to make a project for them, I smell the stink of notes all over these. There are little touches that don't fit in, just things that feel as if they're the brainchild of either an algorithm or an overzealous executive or something like that.
Whereas the films in the Netflix, I mean, I do love those films, Private Life in particular, and you know, the Meyerowitz stories, Roma, The Irishman.
I wanted to mention High Flying Bird, Steven Soderbergh, High Flying Bird, about talent negotiations and basketball. Fascinating movie, really amusing entertainment, great stuff.
So I find it interesting you bring that one up in particular, because a Netflix-specific phenomenon for me is that sense of the sands of time passing very quickly. And there may be this film that they're pushing on their homepage in the spotlight for 1 week, and then if you've not watched it, it's gone. It gets further and further down your list if you are keeping a list at all. And High Flying Bird was one. Dolomite Is My Name was one that I just didn't see back towards the back end of last year whenever it went up on the platform. And now you go on Netflix and these films may not even exist, whereas I suppose the windowing strategies of the traditional film companies would be you'd have 3 or 4 points to actually lock in and watch these films, whereas now Netflix focuses so much on that initial wave of interest and hype.
That's one of the main criticisms to be made of their business model, is that it kind of does not give movies their due. They buy a lot of movies, I've said they've released multiple hundreds, which means that they cannot afford to get the word out about all of them. And often it seems like they're not even especially concerned with getting the word out about the ones that deserve to be promoted. I remember a couple of years ago at Cannes Film Festival, I saw a film called The World Is Yours by Romain Gavras, which is a wonderful French crime comedy with... Isabella Gianni, I believe, is in it. Really, really great stuff. And they purchased it, which I thought was kind of neat. And they did not advertise it at all, ever. And then I have to find out 3 days after the fact that it had been quietly and unceremoniously dropped onto the service, not placed on the homepage or anything like that. Really just left out there to rot, which I felt like was a huge disservice. And so it's frustrating to see things like that, which happen more frequently than you would think. Even you know, when they do sort of put their back into getting a movie out there, I think of Atlantics by Mati mm-hmm. Diop, which came out last year, and they got the word out. But really, critics did a lot of that heavy lifting as far as just, you know, bringing the word to the public. It was on us to let people know that they had a good one on Netflix, you know, just waiting to be watched. And so that's difficult. The promotion department is not the most organized or motivated.
But it's endemic to the platform, isn't it? If you're disrupting all of the processes and workflows behind cinema, then you've already also disrupted the communications and marketing strategies. And how do you then replace it if you're focusing so much on the drop, the upload?
I see. It's strange, you know, working with studio media, everything mattered. The most important thing is running before the day of release. You have to get these things out, you know, the week before the Friday that these movies come out. Netflix, much more comfortable with approving press interviews after the fact. It's week two, mm-hmm. three of something having been out. They will still, you know, if you can get a hold of them, get you in touch with whoever you want to talk to.
Yeah. And so some of my favorite films on the platform are those maybe ones that either flew under the radar or were the smaller projects. I've mentioned Mike Flanagan. I think that Gerald's Game and Hush, his films that are on there, of course, he also did Haunting of Hill House, which is his series, but those two much more specific films really did something for me. And I just looked at your Vulture article that you've not ranked the film Cam.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that. That was the next thing I was going to bring up. That is one of my favorite movies that Netflix has released. I will explain in a moment why I didn't, but if I was to put it on the list, it probably would have cracked the top 10. I think it's a fiendishly uh-huh. clever movie about a cam girl, online cam girl, who finds, she logs on one day to find that there is an identical virtual doppelganger of herself broadcasting from her private cam channel, and her efforts to try to figure out the origin of this and get rid of it really become this very intense psycho thriller. Really, really well written, well shot, yeah. well acted by Madeline Brewer in the main role. And I didn't want to include it with the rankings because prior to the release of the movie, I had befriended the director just around New York while he was living there. And then I met the writer as well, and we all got rather chummy, and it just didn't sit right with me to be, you know, placing that so high up, being like, hey, this movie my friends made is as good as Bong Joon-ho's movie or something.
But I suppose that does mean it's the first film people see when they click on the article because it's not ranked.
They were actually pretty thankful for that. They get a lot of eyeballs that way.
But I'd recommend it to you, and I have no idea who any of these people are. So
there
that's
we go.
A relatively unbiased review as well. Do you think that the fact that people's attention spans refresh like goldfish much more quickly with Netflix than with you know, traditional theatrical releases, that it means that their failures are forgotten more quickly? Or do they still bear the scars of the likes of Bright and Mute and Velvet Buzzsaw?
So I'd say the answer to this is two-pronged, both in that what you're saying is correct, that people sort of just cast aside the failures and don't give those much thought at all. You know, it's not the way like a Pluto Nash sticks to that studio forever and the people who made it get fired and all that shit. No one cares. No one cares is certainly how it seems. People just move on to the next whatever it is. But more to that point, I think that a lot of Netflix's strategy has been oriented around TV for that exact reason, is that the deterioration of the attention span favors bingeable series. These are the things that, you know, you can kill an entire weekend watching and then on Monday discuss with your friends, much in the way one would have water cooler talked about, you know, whatever was playing on HBO on Sunday nights. It's this is sort of the new zeitgeist watch. I'm hardly the first person to bring this up, but mm-hmm. I do think that their platform, even though they release so many movies, is TV first.
Right. And yeah, it's interesting. They seek the zeitgeist rather than anything lasting. I found that with Bird Box, when that had its moments, I saw just as much just chatter about the fact that it's there and people are watching it, rather than people actually enjoying it. Full disclosure.
Think about it now. How many Bird Box fans are out there quoting Bird Box or thinking about Bird Box or having any recollection of Bird Box whatsoever? The staying power with these movies is very spotty, very forgettable yeah. films a lot of the time. You know, even their successes, something like Roma has not quite left the cultural dent that we might have imagined. It's not something, you know, to the extent of, Get Out or even, you know, Star is Born, which seems to have been a larger cultural event.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. And actually, you know, sometimes A24 get branded with a similar brush, that they're seeking to memeify all their films in advance to create a bubble of hype around them. However, yeah, that does actually give them staying power. People are still talking about Uncut Gems a year or so after it's been released.
I think that whole the philosophy of putting the, you know, hipness cart before the horse, that sort of thing, mostly has manifested in them just licensing movies with vivid neon-colored cinematography, which is something I generally like and, you know, easily screenshot it. I feel like that was a big part of the conversation on Uncut Gems. How many blacklight scenes are there? But no, I think that Netflix is less concerned with being a steward of the culture in the way of minting stars, of having, you know, the relationship to the blockbuster is very strange because they have not made too much of an effort to throw their money behind and release movies that, think about the Michael Bay movie Six Underground. Mm. That was not marketed or, you know, it was not sold as a major unmissable blockbuster. It was just a thing that Friday. They don't have their Fast and Furious, which is something that has to maintain the rest of the schedule for an entire summer. That's just not the way they function, which is sort of disorienting because you don't always know what deserves your attention or your time.
And it must be interesting to be Michael Bay in that equation, whereas with Martin Scorsese, the Coen brothers, even Beyond the Grave with Orson Welles, Netflix are the benevolent hand giving a budget that maybe they can't find elsewhere. But Michael Bay is almost trying to strip his ego out of it. It's no longer the big tentpole Bayhem taking over your screen for the weekend in the way that blockbuster would be. It's just another piece of content.
Well, yeah, it is strange because he's working with what certainly visually appears to be more money than ever, and yet exactly what you're saying, it is less of a cultural moment than any of his films. It came and went with barely a peep. I actually enjoyed it. It's pretty stupid, but it's a lot of fun. And he is better at choreographing scenes of destruction than any of these Marvel jokers.
Do you have any other films, maybe under the radar films, that you'd want to shout out?
Let me take a look. See. Oh yes, I quite liked a movie called Apostle, which is by Gareth Evans, a fine horror director who also has done some cool work with martial arts. It is a very unusual, I think, 19th century set horror movie about a guy who goes to an island, and it seems like they're in a sort of Wicker Man cult situation, but then it takes a lot of very dark and nasty turns, very unexpected. I like that one quite a bit, and I think, yeah, Dan Stevens is the guy. I find him a very likable actor. And there's another one called The Perfection, another horror movie. I think Netflix is pretty good with horror because those always thrive with low budgets and minimal oversight. But a nice movie called The Perfection, also rich with twists. These Netflix movies, twists are huge because people write articles explaining what the twists are, and then people click on those articles and then they watch the movies. It's a whole thing. But it's about these dueling viola players, cello players, I believe, cello players. Who go on a trip through China, and all sorts of unfortunate things befall them, some at the hands of each other, some at the hands of others. It's the best, you know, less you know about it, the better. But that movie whips, yeah.
Have you seen Caliber? I guess, of course you have. You put your list together. Where did that come for you?
I enjoyed that one. That is, so it's funny because I say I enjoyed that one and that's at 117, but the list is so long that that's actually kind of high up in the grand scheme of things. But I did like that. Yeah, they're in Scotland, right? They're in the Highlands. The two guys on the sort of stag weekend.
Well, it's almost fits in with those other films you talk about where it feels that Netflix, somebody in development or acquisitions at Netflix goes to Toronto and watches Midnight Madness, or goes into the genre sidebars of film festivals and says, oh, I really liked Green Room and Blue Ruin, let's fund the next Jeremy Saulnier film, which they did. And Caliber definitely feels like the sort of film that would play really well at that small to mid-size festival, but it's given an international platform that it wouldn't have otherwise. And it's got a star in there, or a rising star that Jack Loudon is. And it does hinge on something that happens in the first 20-odd minutes that will hook you and make you want to keep watching, which is a staple of genre cinema, but also any sort of social media wonk from YouTube or Facebook video will say that's what you got to do. You got to get people's attention early. Yeah. So that's why I wonder whether genre is a pretty good fit for something like Netflix. It does keep your attention, and the run times are quite low.
Definitely. It's in the sense that they're, you know, a cheapy factory, it is friendly to the horror genre in that respect. You would think that this would sort of bring in maybe a miniature renaissance for the form, but as many, you know, innovative horror movies as they have produced, there's just so much chaff, a lot of chaff.
Is there anything that, have they approached a so bad it's good sort of trash?
Yes, indeed. I'm glad you asked. So the trouble with reviewing a lot of these Netflix movies is that the bad ones aren't especially entertaining. They're just deadening. Nothing going on there. The one that I love is Tyler Perry made a Netflix movie, the title of which I am about to recite to you. It's called A Fall from Grace. I have a running joke that we should organize a game show in which people quiz me on recalling the titles of, they give me the synopsis of a movie that I've watched and see if I can remember the title, because just I've flushed hundreds of these from my memory banks. But this one I love. Tyler Perry's A Fall from Grace, which is like a sort of Hallmark movie injected with steroids about a older woman of color falls in love with a man who seems to be a good, decent man, then turns out to be an abusive brute. She has to do something about that. She tries to take countermeasures. They go awry. There are like four twists, lots of like The Room, I Have Breast Cancer level bad acting. Oh my God, I love it. I love it.
And that's something interesting. So Tyler Perry is his own institution in the States. And
yes,
in the UK, we don't tend to get his films. So that's something that Netflix can do. We can watch trash of all stripes.
Netflix has an interesting strategy in which they will sometimes, if they like one creator enough, they will just pitch them a huge lump sum of like multiple hundreds of millions of dollars. Like they're doing multi-picture deals like in old times Hollywood. It's they hired Ryan Murphy, cut him a gigantic check to make, you know, several TV shows for them over the course of 10 years or something like that. They cut a huge check to Tyler Perry, who, as you said, was really his own entity, and they wanted to knit him into the Netflix family, I'm sure is a phrase used by someone at some point.
Yeah. So I guess his name had to come eventually, but we should talk about Adam Sandler very quickly.
That's our guy, yeah.
So I guess he's come round to having, you know, a couple of his best movies ever on Netflix, but there was a phase where they cut him that huge check and he could just make what he wanted, right?
Right. So the actual contract, they did a six-picture deal with Adam Sandler. That was, and I think that's been fulfilled. And that was with his production company, which is called Happy Madison. The really great Adam Sandler Netflix movies that people think about, which is Meyerowitz Stories, and not Uncut Gems, because that was A24, but it's on Netflix now. It's, you know, good to have for the brand. And it's because this is what we call cross-promotional synergy, is that if people are watching Adam Sandler in Uncut Gems, they are more likely to watch him in his just execrable, completely fucking unredeemable Happy Madison movies that he makes for this platform. Those are some of the worst, both the ones that he actually stars in and the ones that feature the sort of orbiting heads in his little universe, like David Spade or Rob Schneider.
Are any of them worth the time?
That's a tough question. I'd say the one that is definitely the closest to being worth the time is there's a picture called Sandy Wexler, which is sort of a fictitious biopic. It's a biopic of this fictitious talent agent called Sandy Wexler, who's actually based on this real character that Adam Sandler, when he was younger, and a lot of other comedy types from the 80s, they knew this guy in real life. And that one is sort of funny, laced with Hollywood in jokes, in humor like that. And so I like that one. That one, I guess I will give my pass to, but that's really the only one. This Netflix deal has enabled some of Adam Sandler's most passive, lazy, phoned-in filmmaking. These are sort of glorified vacations that he's taking with actors that he's known for years. They go to a tropical locale, you know, toss off a few creaky jokes. Everybody collects a check. It's very cynical stuff.
We've talked about so many Netflix films here, and the amazing thing looking at, admittedly it's a Wikipedia page, so who knows how much of this is confirmed, but they have so many films on the horizon. So yeah. What are the highlights that you're looking forward to having to watch to put into this list?
I just spoke, I can give you a little tease here. I spoke earlier this week with Eliza Scanlon, who's in the wonderful new film Baby Teeth, and one of the things I was really keen on asking her about is that she's in Antonio Campos' new film, which is called The Devil All the Time. I think he's a real talent, and this sounds interesting. It's a period piece, it's sort of episodic, and I asked her what her role was, and she's like, I can't say too much, but all of her scenes are with Tom Holland and Rob Pattinson. They're in the 1800s, I believe it's... Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's the 1900s, the time between World War II's end and the beginning of Vietnam in Middle America. And so that sounds actually pretty cool. definitely watching that. They have the new David Fincher picture, which is a biopic about the screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz and his battles with Orson Welles over screenplay credits on Citizen Kane. That's obviously going to be amazing. Yeah. It's new David Fincher. Can't blow that. New Charlie Kaufman, film called I'm Thinking of Ending Things, comedy, as is Charlie Kaufman's wont. What else? I mean, I'm rather dubious about this, but they're bringing us Ron Howard's Hillbilly Elegy adaptation, which has become a sort of lightning rod novel in the United States for its rather disparaging portrayal of the South, the American South. What else do we have here? Oh, how about this? Guillermo del Toro's stop-motion Pinocchio, that's going to be his next big feature, that's going to be on Netflix. I didn't even know that. My God, this is such a long list.
I mean, it's too long a list to even, you know, get our head around. And the thing is, I do think it's doing a disservice to Netflix that we don't talk about documentaries. And maybe as the final word, just to nod to the fact that they really have, in some ways, excelled within the documentary form. Admittedly, they have reinvented the popular water cooler documentary with your Tiger Kings and Making a Murderer and so on. But there are some great creative documentaries that are experimenting with the form. Films like Strong Island and Shirkers, casting JonBenet, films that I saw at festivals like Sheffield Docfest or Berlin or CPH Docs in Copenhagen, and I see them and I think these are amazing festival films. Will they even ever come out? And Netflix then turns that something, that nothing into something, and it's available worldwide, and you can point to it and say, go and watch Strong Island now.
Just last year, they released Oscar winner, I believe, American Factory, which is about sort of a friction between American auto workers who were being repurposed in a Chinese glass factory. Really fascinating stuff that was definitely seen by more eyeballs. I think that would not have won the Oscar without the support of Netflix. And so as jaded as I might be, having seen all these movies, I cannot deny that, you know, they have brought a lot of good work to a very wide swath of the public.
And they've brought a lot of work to your plate as well, Charles.
And they have paid my rent many, many times over. That is perhaps worth mentioning as well.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for joining me and talking through the Netflix phenomenon. Listeners, let us know what your take on Netflix is. If you have any underseen gems that you'd like to recommend to us, you can do that at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email. And of course, there's the comment section at lwlies.com/podcast. Charles, thank you so much for joining me today.
Ah, always a treat.
I'm Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.